lecture isn't so much a conclusion as an image. I want you to take away that image at the core of Aristotle's logic, the square of opposition. Picture the categorical propositions laid out that way. Universal across the top, particular across the bottom, positive to the left side, negative to the right. With that image, the core logical relations are laid out before you. Contradictions on the diagonals. They can't both be true, they can't both be false. Implications down the sides. If the first is true, the second is. That gives us counterindications too. If the second is false, so is the first. Contraries across the top. Contradictions weaker sister. They couldn't both be true, but they could both be false. Subcontraries across the bottom. They couldn't both be false, but they could both be true. We threw in converses and contrapositives for good measure. We'll return to Aristotle in the next lecture. With a break for creative thinking, we'll then take our logic well beyond him. In the last lecture, I introduced the logic of Aristotle in terms of a central visualization, the square of opposition. I want you to call that image to mind. Here's a quick review. In Venn diagrams, we use overlapping circles S and P for the two concepts involved. We black out areas to indicate there's nothing in that area. We use an X to indicate there is something there. All SRP is in the upper left of the square of opposition. We black out the area of S that isn't in the overlap with P. If all S are P, there aren't any that aren't P. No S or P is on the upper right. In this case, there's nothing in the overlap of S and P, so we black that out. In the lower left is some S are P. We use an X in the intersection to show that there's at least something in the overlap. Something is both S and P. Some S are not P is lower right, with an X in the outer S area to indicate there's at least one S outside the overlap with P. Some S's are not P. Then the magic. Contradictories are on the diagonals. They can't both be true, and they can't both be false. If one's true, the other has to be false. If one's false, the other has to be true. Implications run down the sides. If the upper one is true, the lower one is true. In that direction, truth is contagious. It flows from the top to the bottom. We call the correlate movement from the bottom up counterindication. If the lower one's false, the upper one has to be false too. Contraries face each other across the top. Both can be false, but both can't be true. Subcontraries face each other across the bottom. Both can be true. Some are, some aren't, but both can't be false. This time, I want to give you the rest of Aristotle's logic using another visualization. All of Aristotle's logic in two lectures. That's not bad, considering that Aristotle's logic remained the gold standard for over 2,000 years. Aristotle invented logic. At the core of that logic, and of all logic since, is one breathtaking idea. Maybe we can systematize thought. Concepts are the atoms of thought. In combination, they form the molecules we call propositions. It's the fundamental relations between propositions that shine out in the square of opposition. But it's the next step that's really the most important. Propositions don't just stand alone. Propositions go together to form arguments. In arguments, you see the dynamics of thought. Reasoning involves moving from one proposition to another and another beyond that. That's the movement of argument, from premises to a conclusion. There was a Monty Python skit called The Argument Clinic. I'm sure you can find it online. In that skit, Michael Palin plays the client. John Cleese is the guy behind the desk. Michael Palin enters the room. Is this the right room for an argument? I've told you once, says Cleese. No, you haven't. Yes, I have. It goes downhill from there. The whole joke turns on the term argument. What Cleese means by argument is the everyday sense of bickering conflict. At one point, the client says, an argument isn't just contradiction. An argument is a connected series of statements intended to establish a proposition. That's our sense of argument, the philosophical sense. A connected series of statements intended to establish a proposition. An argument, in our sense, represents the conceptual dynamic from proposition to proposition to conclusion. It's that movement of thought that is central to all rationality. But of course, it's not just intended transition that's important. We want to be able to evaluate arguments. When do a set of reasons really give you a solid inference? When does evidence really support a hypothesis? When do premises really entail a conclusion? What guarantees that a transition of thought is a rational transition? Those are questions about validity. When is the dynamics of thought rational? When is an argument valid? That's what Aristotle was after. That's what all logic is after. The whole purpose of logic is to capture validity, the crucial category of argument evaluation. Maybe we can systematize thought by capturing what makes it rational. Maybe we can formalize validity. Let me emphasize what that means. An argument is valid if the link between premises and conclusion is logically tight. I'll talk more about truth in a bit. The important first point, however, is that validity and truth are importantly different. The validity of an argument, the fact that there's a tight logical connection between premises and conclusion, doesn't guarantee that the premises are true. It doesn't guarantee that the conclusion's true. What you know when you know that an argument is valid is just this: if the premises are true, the conclusion must be true. That's important information, but it's conditional information. What you know is that the conclusion has to be true if the premises are true. In this lecture, I want to talk about ironclad, airtight validity. I'll leave lesser shades to a later lecture. We're starting with Aristotle, and Aristotle took as his target validity in the highest degree. Here's what it means for an argument to be valid in that strongest sense. If the premises are true, the conclusion absolutely must be true. If the premises are true, it's impossible for the conclusion to be false. You can't get a much tighter connection than that. If the premises are true, the conclusion is absolutely guaranteed. Let me give you three short arguments, each with two premises and a conclusion. You tell me which ones are valid. First argument: rice is grown in every county of Louisiana. Any county that grows rice also harvests crawfish. Conclusion: crawfish are harvested in every county of Louisiana. Valid or invalid? Second argument: all purple vegetables are poisonous. Carrots are a purple vegetable. Conclusion: carrots are poisonous. Valid or invalid? Third argument: the Declaration of Independence lays down a principle of self-determination, a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. One man, one vote is a core principle in democratic decision-making. Conclusion: presumed innocent until proven guilty is a major principle of American law. Valid or invalid? Which of those are valid arguments? If you said the first two are valid and that the third one is not, you're absolutely right. But look at how that differs from truth. The propositions of the first argument may well be true, but when the question is validity, their truth doesn't really matter. If they're true, the conclusion has to be too. Validity is about the logical connection between premises and conclusion. All purple vegetables are poisonous. Carrots are a purple vegetable. Conclusion: carrots are poisonous. That's perfectly ridiculous, but it's also perfectly valid. Not all purple vegetables are poisonous, but suppose they were. Carrots aren't a purple vegetable, but suppose they were. If those two premises were both true, if carrots were purple vegetables and all purple vegetables were poisonous, it would also have to be true that carrots were poisonous. The first was a valid argument with true claims. The second was a valid argument with silly claims. In the third argument, we have all true claims again, but it's not valid. The Declaration of Independence lays down a principle of self-determination, a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. One man, one vote is a core principle in democratic decision making. Conclusion, presumed innocent until proven guilty is a major principle of American law. Those are all propositions about principles. They're all true. But that's not enough to make a valid argument. They lack the logical connection that validity demands. So let me see if you've got this. Suppose you've got an argument in which all premises and the conclusion are true. Is that a valid argument? Not necessarily. It's the connection that matters. You might have a valid argument in which all premises and the conclusion are true. That'd be great. But validity alone doesn't tell you that. You might have a valid argument in which all the premises and the conclusion are false. The purple carrots was one of those. You might, in fact, have a valid argument in which the premises are false, but the conclusion is true. Here's one. Everything poisonous is orange. Carrots are poisonous. Therefore, carrots are orange. That's a valid argument. If the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. The premises are false, but they entail a conclusion that's true anyway. I guess sometimes two wrongs do make a right. There's only one pattern of truth and falsity that validity rules out. You will never find a valid argument that goes from true premises to a false conclusion. A valid argument is one in which, if the premises are true, the conclusion must be true. Aristotle's goal, the goal of all logic, is to capture what it is about an argument that makes it valid. The core insight: validity doesn't turn on what an argument is about. Validity is a matter of structure. Here, for example, are two arguments about very different things. Argument one, another silly one. All carrots are legumes. All legumes are delicious. Conclusion, all carrots are delicious. Argument two, not so silly. All countries in the Middle East are in turmoil. All states in turmoil have unpredictable futures. Conclusion, all countries in the Middle East have unpredictable futures. If one of those is valid, the other one is valid. Why? Because validity depends purely on the structure of the argument. Both of those have this structure. All A's are B's. All B's are C's. Conclusion, all A's are C's. Validity depends not on content, but on structure. I don't think I would have ever seen that. Reasoning is so thoroughly human, as context-bound as the things it's about, as variable as the humans who do it. I don't think I would ever have seen that what makes it real reasoning, that what makes something a valid argument, is a matter of abstract structure. For that, we needed an Aristotle. Aristotle worked out the structure of ironclad validity in terms of three-step arguments called syllogisms. A syllogism takes us from categories to propositions to steps in an argument. It uses three categories overall, A, B, and C. It links those categories in pairs to make categorical propositions. All A's are B's. Some B's are not C's. The syllogism itself is an argument in three propositional steps with maybe a structure like this. All A's are B's. Some B's are not C's. No C's are A's. Some syllogisms are valid. Some are not. The one I just gave you is a syllogism, sure enough, but it's not a valid syllogism. So, is there some way of sorting the sheep from the goats? Is there some way of sorting the valid syllogisms from the invalid ones? There are lots of ways. The medieval monks memorized an exhaustive list using a code in terms of women's names to remember which syllogisms were valid and which weren't. Yep, those celibate medieval monks learned their logic by memorizing women's names. Barbara is virtuous and valid. Celise is not. But there is a much easier way. Here again, visualization is the key. We can do all of Aristotle's logic with the Venn diagrams you already have at your disposal. Remember the Venn diagrams for the categorical propositions. All SRP, no SRP, some SRP, some S are not P. Those are the propositional elements of syllogistic logic. But we said that syllogisms involve three propositions. Each proposition of the syllogism, each step in the argument, uses just two of our three categories. In order to use Venn diagrams to track validity, we need to overlap three circles into a triangular Venn diagram. Our first proposition, linking categories A and B, will look something like this. Our second, linking B and C, will look something like this. Our third, linking A and C, will look like this. All three categories and all three propositions come together in the syllogism. We put them together like this. The result is an overlap of three categories, just as the syllogism always involves three categories. The triangle is formed from three categorical propositions, pairs of linked circles. You should learn to see each of those pairs individually in that diagram. Let's take an easy syllogism. The medieval monks called it Barbara. All proteins are polypeptides. All polypeptides function by elaborate folding. Therefore, all proteins function by elaborate folding. That one's obviously valid. I'll use it to introduce the technique, which can then be used for cases that aren't so obvious. We've got three categories: proteins, polypeptides, and function by elaborate folding. We label the three circles in the diagram accordingly. We now enter each of our premises in Venn diagram style. So enter our first premise: all proteins are polypeptides. In order to do this, we act as if that bottom circle isn't even there. Fill in the shaded area just like we did before for all SRP. That'll mean shading in that whole left portion of proteins. All proteins are polypeptides. Now take the second proposition. All polypeptides function by elaborate folding. That premise is just about polypeptides and folding. We therefore concentrate on that part of the diagram, ignoring the protein circle. How do you represent all polypeptides function by elaborate folding? By striking out any polypeptides that aren't in the overlap with function by elaborate folding. Now step back and look at the diagram as a whole. Philosophers talk of logical space, and what we've just done is to map the logical space of our first two propositions. If those are both true, the diagram shows what the categorical universe must look like. Here comes the last step, the crucial step in telling whether a syllogism is valid. Some people find it the trickiest. We want to look at our third proposition, the conclusion, and ask whether its information is already in the diagram we've constructed for our premises. If it is, the argument is valid. If it's not, the argument is invalid. If the concluding information is already provided by the premises, it has to be true when they are valid. If the premises don't give us that information, the conclusion doesn't follow from the premises. Invalid. In order to test for validity, we want to know whether the concluding information is already there in the logical space of the premises. So, look at the diagram. What would it mean to draw in the conclusion, all proteins function by elaborate folding? That would mean looking at just protein and elaborate folding, those two circles on the left. For it to be true that all proteins function by elaborate folding, the protein area outside of the overlap would be blacked out. Take a look. That area is already blacked out. There aren't any proteins in our diagram that aren't already squeezed into some part of the function by elaborate folding area. That means that the information in step three, the information in the conclusion, was already there in the premises. The sign of validity. If the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. The information in the premises is sufficient to give us the information in the conclusion. The argument is valid. Think about that a minute, and let me emphasize two points. The first point is that what I've just told you actually does make sense. Let me convince you of that. I'll then deal with some lingering disappointment. Here's the make sense part. If we graph the information in the premises, and the information offered by the conclusion is already there, the argument is valid. Remember, we're talking about the highest degree of validity. If the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. That's what's happening here. If the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true precisely because the information in the conclusion is already there in the premises. If that weren't the case, if somehow the conclusion was telling you something new, then the information in the conclusion wouldn't already be in the premises. It would be independent of the premises, a rogue conclusion from somewhere else, not from the premises, and thus the argument wouldn't be valid. So it does make sense. A valid argument in the deductive sense is one that squeezes out in the conclusion some information that you already had. Kant speaks of an analytic proposition as one in which the predicate is already contained in the subject term. A valid deductive argument is one in which the information in the conclusion is already contained in the premises. It therefore makes sense that you can show an argument to be valid or invalid depending on whether the information in the conclusion is information already there in the premises. But that's a little disappointing. It means that a syllogism will never give you any really new information. I have a memory along those lines that I can date to when I was 5. Somehow, I'd gotten the idea of a syllogism, or at least of stepped reasoning, though I'm not sure where. I would try to deduce conclusions as I imagined Sherlock Holmes would. Walking up the street to Wendy's house, I remember thinking something like this. If Wendy's brother is home, Brian is home. If Brian is home, Wendy won't be the only one home. So, if Wendy's brother is home, Wendy won't be the only one home. But that's obvious. I knew that already. I wanted ironclad, airtight, valid reasoning that would give me some genuinely new information. But whenever it was airtight, that kind of reasoning never seemed to give me anything new. I found that very disappointing when I was 5. Maybe I'm still a little disappointed. You can do all of Aristotle's logic, all the logic of the medievals, all the logic that we had for 2,000 years with those three circles. It gets a little trickier with the X's in some are or some are not, but not a whole lot. Consider, for example, anything alkaline turns red litmus paper blue. Some poisons are alkaline, therefore, all poisons turn red litmus paper blue. Valid or invalid? Use the three circles again, this time marked alkaline, poison, and turns litmus paper blue. Now, using your ability to concentrate on just two circles at a time, put in the information of the first premise. Anything alkaline turns red litmus paper blue. That means nothing alkaline is outside of the turns red litmus paper blue area. We black out that upper left portion. Now what about the second premise? Some poisons are alkaline. That means that there is something, we'll say at least one thing, that's in the intersection of the left two circles. When we go to put it there, of course, we see that part of that area is blacked out already. Nothing there, so our x can't go there. It'll have to wedge into that middle area. There, right in front of us, we have all the information contained in our premises. Step 3, we test the syllogism by seeing whether the conclusion would tell us anything new. What does the conclusion say, and how would we graph that? All poisons turn litmus paper blue. That would mean that there are no poisons outside of the turns litmus paper blue area. Is that information there already? Is that information we have already? No. If it were there, that lower area would be blacked out already, but it isn't. We have a rogue conclusion. In addition to logical space beyond our premises, it doesn't follow. That argument is invalid. There were actually two little tricks in that last example that are worth noting as we go by. One is this. I quickly went from some poisons are alkaline to at least one. That is, in fact, a standard move in logic, to read some as meaning at least one. It's so standard, in fact, that it's become the technical meaning for some in standardized tests. If you ever have to take the GREs, the LSATs, the MCATs, and there's a question about some, just reread it as at least one. That makes things easier. But even logicians have to admit that it doesn't fit very well with how we ordinarily talk. In normal usage, the word some at least implies a plurality. If I just got married, I have a wife. Count them, one. So I guess it's true that I have at least one wife. But it would certainly be peculiar to say, I just got married, so I have some wives. The other trick in that last example is a visualization trick. We drew in the universal premise first. Anything alkaline turns red litmus paper blue. That told us, when our x arrived, that it had to squeeze over into the remaining white area. What if we had done the sum proposition first? Where would we have put the x? We would know that it would go in the overlap of poison and alkaline, for example, but on which side of that other line that's in there? In that case, we'd put it on the line in the relevant area as a way of reminding us that it might be on either side. A further universal premise might tell us that we have to nudge it one way or the other. That's how it works. In order to really incorporate Aristotle's logic, one needs to practice with lots of cases. But the technique's guaranteed. Every time, if you do it right, you'll be able to distinguish a deductively valid categorical syllogism from an invalid one. Here's another one for you to try. All absentee ballots have been counted. Some counted ballots were illegible. Therefore, some absentee ballots were illegible. Stop the tape, take a minute, and work it out. Valid or invalid? Here's what your diagram of the premises should look like. The conclusion is some absentee ballots were illegible. Is that information already there? No. It would be there if we knew that x, that's somewhere in the overlap between counted and illegible, were in that central area that's also the overlap between absentee and counted ballots. But we don't know that. We only know it's somewhere in that larger overlap. It could be in either portion. That makes sense. The first premise tells us that all absentee ballots were counted. But we don't know that only absentee ballots were counted. The second premise tells us that some counted ballots are illegible. It doesn't tell us which ones. The possibility is therefore left open that the counted and illegible ballots are not the absentee ones. In that case, it wouldn't be true that some absentee ballots were illegible. In that case, the premises would be true, but the conclusion false. The truth of those premises doesn't guarantee the truth of the conclusion. The argument is invalid. What I want you to remember is that three-circle technique and the concept of airtight, ironclad validity that it represents. With that visualization, you can test validity for any three-step syllogism. With that visualization, you have all of Aristotle's logic at your fingertips. But let me return for a minute to that aspect of disappointment. The concept of airtight, ironclad validity sets a standard for inference in which all the information in a conclusion has to already be contained somehow in the premises. For 2,000 years, ironclad, airtight validity was held up as the gold standard for all knowledge. But that meant all information had to flow from above, from something you already knew. Mathematics is about the only discipline that works that way. It's no surprise that axiomatic geometry was the standard for all knowledge. Aristotle's legacy, therefore, had a downside, too. It was only with the rise of empirical science and figures like Galileo that an alternative became clear. Maybe an inference from observed cases to universal laws is what we need. Maybe it's legitimate. Maybe it's rational, even if it isn't ironclad guaranteed in Aristotle's sense. If you weaken the demands on validity, you get the possibility of rational information expansion for the first time. Reasoning together with observation that offers new information. Ironclad won't give you new information. Anything that gives you new information won't be ironclad. We have bought the benefits of science by weakening our demands on validity, by giving up full Aristotelian certainty. I think it was worth the price. We'll start talking about reasoning and validity in that wider sense a few lectures down the line. Next time, however, I want to take a break for something equally important, but a little more fun. Next time, I want to offer a workshop on creative thinking. In this lecture, I want to take a break from Aristotle, a break from visualizing argument structure, in order to talk about what may be the most important kind of thinking of all, also the most fun, creative thinking, lateral thinking, thinking outside the box. In order to deal with creative thinking, I'm going to have to use a different kind of lecture. This will be more of a workshop than a lecture, a workshop in creative sideways thinking. Because of that, you'll have to participate in a different way. I'll need you to stop the lecture occasionally in order to think about a problem and manipulate some objects. When you have a solution, start the lecture again and move on. You'll need a creative thinking kit for this workshop. Your kit will have to include each of these things, as they say, familiar items from around the house. 12 toothpicks. Pencils would work too. 10 small circular objects, pennies, buttons, or the like. If you have 10 of those miniature marshmallows, those would be great. 2 wrapped lollipops, and a picture that appears in your guidebook. You'll need a pencil to write with. You also need a friend. At the very end, I'll be asking you to bring in a friend for participation. If you can assemble that list of things and you're in a situation in which you can start and stop the lecture at will, we're ready to go. If that's not possible right now, go on to another lecture and come back to this one. Ready? Let's go. I'll start with an experiment. I'm going to spell a word. I want you to pronounce it. So how is this pronounced? M-A-C. That's right, Mac. M-A-C-N-A-M-A-R-A. Quick now. McNamara, that's right. M-A-C-H-I-N-E. Did you say McHine? If so, think about it again. M-A-C-H-I-N-E spells machine. Here's another experiment, this time in the form of a puzzle. A cowboy rides into town on Tuesday. He stays in town for exactly 3 days. On the first day, he works in the general store. On the second day, he works in the livery stable. On the third day, he hangs out in the sheriff's office. He leaves promptly the next day and rides out of town on Tuesday. How can that be? The cowboy puzzle is as old as the hills, what they call a chestnut. If you don't know the answer, pause the lecture for a few minutes to think about it, then come back. How can that be? The answer is that his horse is named Tuesday. He rides into town on Tuesday, stays 3 days, and rides out again on Tuesday. Both of those experiments illustrate the phenomenon of mental set, or expectancy. You are led into thinking about things a certain way. You aren't able to change perspectives quickly enough to solve the puzzle. In the machine case, the whole setup leads you to expect a hard C in the next Mac word, not the soft sh of machine. In the Tuesday case, the whole setup is intended to get you to think in terms of days. One day in the general store, one day in the livery stable, blinding you to the fact that Tuesday could also be the name of a horse. Mental set or expectancy is a well-established psychological phenomenon. We learn to anticipate particular patterns or continuations of patterns. We get stuck in a pattern rut. Creativity involves breaking that mental set, getting out of that rut, exploring unanticipated options. Interestingly, mental set can change with the culture over time. Here's a chestnut that no longer works. It stumps almost nobody, but it used to. A father and his son are both hurt in an automobile accident, and the son is rushed to the hospital for immediate surgery. The surgeon looks down at the boy and says, "I can't operate on him. He's my son." How can that be? The answer, of course, is that the surgeon is his mother. At one time, the cultural presumption was that a surgeon must be male, and that made the puzzle hard. It isn't the problem that's changed. It's the mental sets of our cultural expectations. Creative thinking demands being able to break the mental set or expectancy that a problem brings with it. That mental set is the box. Creative thinking is thinking outside the box. Don't get me wrong. For some problems, you need a standard pattern, a template designed for that kind of problem. That holds, for example, for the kinds of problems that appear on standardized tests. Standardized tests often have a section with problems like this. There are 5 women at the fair, Mrs. A, Mrs. B, Mrs. C, Miss D, and Miss E. On the basis of the following elimination, tell us who's wearing which color, red, gray, brown, or yellow. 2 of the women are wearing the same color. The married women are wearing the brightest colors. Mrs. C hates her red dress and wishes she were wearing the same color as the other married women. Miss E is wearing gray. The standard template for solving problems like that is the visualization we mentioned in an earlier lecture. Construct a matrix, a checkerboard of squares. Mrs. A, Mrs. B, Mrs. C, Mrs. D, and Miss E are written above the columns. Red, gray, brown, and yellow appear as labels on the rows. By process of elimination, you can use the information given and fill in the squares to find out who's wearing what color. There are only so many types of questions on standardized tests. What's taught in prep courses are a handful of templates for those kinds of questions. Once you've mastered the templates, the only challenge is to recognize which template to apply to a specific problem. Real life tends not to be like that. Most real life problems don't come in a tidy format with a standard cookie-cutter answer. Often, real-life problems, when they can be solved at all, can be solved only by looking at things an entirely different way. The same thing holds for life's real opportunities. Opportunities may be invisible unless you can look at a situation differently, sideways, unless you can think outside the box. Real problems and real opportunities demand more than standardized thinking. For real life, we often need some real creativity. How about this one? A man walks into a bar. The bartender pulls a gun from behind the counter and points it at him. The man says, "Thank you," and leaves. Why? Why would the bartender pull a gun? And why on earth would the man say, "Thank you"? You may know the answer immediately. If not, think about it, and then come back. You've undoubtedly heard that a surprise or a shock is a sure cure for hiccups. The man entering the bar has the hiccups. The bartender pulls a gun and points it at him to help with the hiccups. That's why he says, "Thank you." Let me give you another puzzle before I move on to some real-world examples. A man lives in a penthouse apartment in New York City. When he goes to work, he takes the elevator down to the lobby. When he comes home, he only takes it halfway up. Unless it's raining, when he takes it all the way up. Why? Press pause and take a little time to think about it, then come back. Why does he only go halfway up to his apartment, unless it's raining? Because he's very short. He can only reach the lower buttons in the elevator. But when it rains, he carries his umbrella. With his umbrella, he can punch the top buttons. What was the mental set or expectancy that you had to break in this case? Unlike the others, it wasn't something imposed by the language of the puzzle. Here, the whole key was to think about something that wasn't mentioned at all. How tall he was. Let me give you some stories that go beyond puzzles. I've heard these are based on real events. I can't vouch for that, but they certainly do make the point that creative thinking may not be just an entertaining add-on. It may be a necessity in a crisis. A woman is driving across the desert without a cell phone and has a flat tire in the pouring rain. She manages to jack up the car and takes off the 5 nuts on the wheel. Just then, a flash flood washes the nuts beyond recovery deep in the sand. How can she get the car back on the road? If you know the answer, stay with me. If not, press pause. Here's a creative solution. She's lost the 5 nuts from that wheel, but still has 5 nuts on each of the other 3. Borrow a nut from each of the others, use those 3 nuts on this wheel, and she can be on her way. Another case. Some friends are swimming together in a pond. The area is residential. The pond is ringed with lawns and gardens, but it's deep and it has a tangle of water plants at the bottom. One of the friends becomes entangled in the pond plants underwater just a foot from the surface of the pool. He's struggling desperately, but his friends realize they won't be able to free him in time. What else could they do? The story is that they grabbed a garden hose from a yard nearby, cut a 2-foot segment with a pair of garden shears, and gave him a makeshift snorkel to use until they could get help to work him free. That's creative thinking when it's needed most. I'm not even sure they needed the garden shears. The hose itself could work as an air supply. Creative thinking can't be taught by handing you a template, but it can be cultivated. You can learn to broaden the horizon of possibilities you consider. You can learn to first recognize what the box is and then deliberately look for a way to think outside it. So here are some exercises along those lines. I'll talk in terms of toothpicks, though you could use pencils or any other 12 sticks of the same size. I want you to take your 12 toothpicks and arrange them into this pattern. 4 squares made out of 12 toothpicks. Square 1, square 2, square 3, square 4. Now, here's the challenge. By removing 2 toothpicks, only 2, and without moving any other toothpicks, I want you to end up looking not at 4 squares, but only at 2. They have to be squares, not rectangles. And I want 2 squares with nothing else, no detritus, no floating toothpicks that aren't part of any square. Press pause and take a few minutes to figure out how to cut the figure down from 4 squares to 2 by removing just 2 toothpicks. When you think you've got it, come back. Here's the solution. Remove two neighboring toothpicks, like this. If you do that, you'll be looking at one large square with a smaller one tucked into the corner. By removing two toothpicks, moving none of the others, you end up with two squares, just like I asked for, no leftovers, just like I insisted. Of course, those squares aren't the same size, and they're not two of the original four. If there was a mental set imposed by the problem, it was the expectation that the two remaining squares would be two of the four you started with. That was the mold you had to break in order to think about the problem a different way. Let's try another exercise. In your guidebook is a picture with nine dots, three evenly spaced rows of three. In fact, they look just like the points at which our toothpicks met in the last case. With a pencil, I'm going to ask you to connect all nine dots by drawing four straight lines without taking your pencil off the paper. You'll draw a line, then start the next one from where that stopped and so forth for a total of just four straight lines. Those four straight lines will go through the middle of all nine dots. See if you can do that. Four straight lines passing through all the dots without lifting your pencil from the page. Pause the lecture and come back when you think you've solved it. The key is that your lines don't all have to start and stop at a dot. In order to solve the problem, your lines will have to extend beyond the box of nine and turn some corners outside of it. There are several ways to do this. Here's one. Draw your first line on the diagonal from the top left dot through the middle dot to the bottom right dot. When you're at the dot at the bottom, draw your second line straight up the right side of the box, but keep going beyond that corner of the box. Go up far enough so that drawing your third line at a 45-degree angle down to the left will catch those two highest unconnected dots. You'll cross your original line. Continue that third line outside the box until you can turn right to catch the bottom row of dots with your fourth line. Like I said, there are other ways of drawing the lines, but they all require extending lines beyond the box of dots. Is that something like what you did? If so, you're thinking creatively. If so, you're literally thinking outside the box. Here's the third problem. Take your 10 circular objects, marshmallows, buttons, whatever. I'll call them pennies. I want you to arrange those pennies in such a way that you have five straight lines of pennies, five rows, each of which has exactly four pennies in the row. Five straight lines of four pennies using just 10 pennies in all. This one's harder for most people. I know it was for me. Take a few minutes and see if you can get it. Here's the solution. Draw a five-pointed star. It'll have five points and five inside corners, the star's armpits. Make the picture big enough to put a penny at each point, each outer point, and each inner corner. If you drew your star with a flourish of overlapping lines, like people often do, put a penny at each outer point and at the inside corners where your lines cross. When you do that, you'll find that you have five lines, each with four pennies, for a total of 10. If you didn't solve that one, what mental set got in the way? Was it that you expected the lines to be parallel? Was it that you expected them to cross only at right angles? If you analyze your own thinking on problems like these, you'll get a feeling for the kinds of boxes you need to break out of. What we're doing is trying to develop an ability to think beyond the expected, to look for options that aren't anticipated in the question or the situation. We're trying to develop an ability to think creatively, maybe even develop a habit of breaking habits of thought. For the next exercise, take just eight of your round objects. I want you to imagine that these are eight coins, all of which look and feel alike. One of them is different, however, in ways indistinguishable by look or feel. All are exactly the same weight, except one. One of the eight weighs just a little more than the others. You also have a balance scale. It won't tell you the precise weight of anything, but it will tell you whether the thing you put on one side is heavier or equal to the thing on the other side. It won't say 3 ounces, but if you put anything on one side and anything on the other side, it'll tell you which side is heavier or whether both sides weigh the same. Okay, each time you put things into the scale and weigh them, that counts as one weighing. You've got 8 coins in front of you. In just 2 weighings, how would you find the single coin that weighs more? I want you to tell me, first I'll weigh this, then I'll weigh that, and that'll tell me precisely which of the 8 coins is heavier. Take a minute, think about that one, and then get back to me. When most people first approach the weighing problem, they think of dividing the 8 coins in half. 4 on one side of the scale, 4 on the other side. That would tell you that the heavy coin is on, oh, one side, maybe this one. But then how do you get the 4 coins on the heavy side down to the single heavier coin in just one weighing? If you divide them in half, you'll only know that the heavy coin is 1 of 2. And that's not what we want. Most people's initial expectation is that the problem will be solved with that kind of symmetry. Lots of problems are. But for this one, you have to think asymmetrically. On the first weighing, put 3 coins on each side of the scale. 6 coins on the scale. 3 on this side, 3 over here, and 2 left out over here. With that first weighing, 1 of 2 things might happen. It might come out that both groups of 3 weigh the same. That would be great. It means the heavier coin has to be 1 of the remaining 2, and a single additional weighing will find it. The other thing that might happen is that 1 of the groups of 3 weighs more. You'll then know that the heavy coin is 1 of the 3. So do the same thing. Weigh just 2 of the 3 coins. If one of these weighs more, you've found your coin, your man. If they weigh the same, you know that the one that doesn't weigh the same is that one. Once again, you've found your man, or well, you've found your coin. This one's easier. Here's a picture of a cake. It's just a squat little cylinder with a dotted line across the diameter of the top. What that dotted line shows you is how to cut the cake into 2 equal parts. Now, just because a problem calls for creative thinking doesn't mean it has to be hard. And maybe you're better at creative thinking already. If I asked you to make 2 straight cuts that cut the cake into 4 equal parts, I'm sure you could do that. I'll ask for something a little harder. Give me 3 straight cuts that'll cut the cake into 8 equal parts. Start the lecture again when you have the answer. The answer is to do 2 cross cuts across the top, like you would in dividing the cake into 4 pieces, then do 1 sideways, all the way through the body of the cake. That's thinking sideways. You end up with 8 equal pieces, equal by volume anyway. Though if you really like frosting, you'd still want 1 of the top pieces. The last item on your list was a friend. For the last 2 problems, I want you to work side by side with your friend. We'll see who solves these problems first. You have 12 toothpicks. Give 6 to your friend. I want each of you to lay 3 of those toothpicks down in front of you to form a triangle. Here's the challenge. By adding just 3 more toothpicks, I want each of you to form 4 triangles of precisely the shape and size as the one you just made. That's right, just 6 toothpicks, but 4 triangles of precisely the size and shape as the one you started with. Let's see who gets it first. Here's our original triangle. How do you get 4 triangles of exactly that size and shape with just 3 more toothpicks? Here, creative thinking takes you literally into another dimension. On top of your original 2-dimensional triangle, form a 3-dimensional pyramid with your 3 additional toothpicks. There you have it, four triangles of precisely the shape and size as the original. If you want it to stand on its own, of course, you'll need those toothpicks to stick together. That's where the miniature marshmallows work great. In order to get that problem, you had to move conceptually beyond two dimensions and into three. There's a wonderfully creative little book on that theme, written in 1884 by the English schoolmaster Edwin Abbott Abbott. It's called Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions. Abbott's narrator is A Square, who lives in a two-dimensional plane, unable to conceive or understand what happens when things enter into that two-dimensional world from a three-dimensional outside. It's a charming little story in its own right, and a wonderful metaphor for the kinds of conceptual limitations we inevitably carry with us. It's important that your friend is along for the ride on this last exercise, too. Here again, we'll see who finds the answer first. Give your friend one of the wrapped lollipops. I want each of you to put that lollipop, still wrapped, on a table in front of you. Now, you can't touch your lollipop with your hands or elbows. Without getting your nose closer than 6 inches to the table, I want you to get that lollipop unwrapped and into your mouth. Press pause and come back to the lecture when you're happily sucking on your lollipop. Did you get it? I hope so. You couldn't have picked it up with your mouth because you weren't supposed to get your nose closer than 6 inches to the table. But you could use your mouth in another way. You could use your mouth by turning to your friend and saying, "Will you please unwrap that lollipop and put it in my mouth?" Sometimes the best way to solve a problem, sometimes the most creative way, is not to try to solve it alone. Sometimes the best way to solve a problem is to ask a friend to help. The whole idea of creative problem solving is to break the mold, change the mental set, and approach the issue from an entirely new direction. That can't be taught by handing you a template, but it is an ability that can be developed with practice. Here's an exercise for still more practice. Take an ordinary object, a brick, for example. How many things can you think to do with a brick? The more you can think of, the more creative you're thinking. Most people can think of using a brick as a doorstop, perhaps a bookend, but there's no limit to the things you can do with a brick. Put it on your head and learn to walk like a lady. Break a window. Get into your car when the keys are locked inside. Save water in your toilet tank. Use it as a weapon. Wrap it as a present. Grind it on the pavement to make some war paint. Use it to prop up a table. Open nuts with it. Kill bugs. Step on it to reach the high shelf. Use it as a weight measure. Use it as a ruler. Warm it up and put it in bed in the cold weather. See if you can figure out 50 things to do with a brick. We've been talking all along about thinking outside the box. That's a metaphor, of course. But some recent experiments indicate it may be a particularly apt metaphor. 100 undergraduates were given a word task designed to measure innovative thinking. Half of them had to do the task inside a 5-foot square box made of plastic pipe and cardboard. Half did it outside of and next to the box. You guessed it, those who were doing their thinking outside the box came up with 20% more creative solutions. The same kinds of differences showed up between students who had to walk a particular path as they worked on the problem, as opposed to those who could wander at will. Those who could leave the beaten path came up with 25% more original ideas. In the first lecture, we emphasized that physical context can make a mental difference. That's what's happening here. Sometimes creativity demands that you really do get away from it all. I'll leave you with one final creative thinking puzzle. I got this from my one-time colleague, Anthony Weston. It's a dark and stormy night, and you're driving in your sports car, a good-looking little car, but with only two seats, like an old MG. Suddenly, by the side of the road, you see three people stranded at a bus stop. One is a stranger who's having a heart attack at that very moment. Another is a childhood friend who has often saved your life. He's long been begging to ride in your sports car. The third person is the man or woman of your dreams. It's love at first sight. You recognize that you've suddenly found your soulmate who you may